This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Back for Dustin Byfuglien, scores! Dustin Byfuglien wires it from the line. 3-2 Nashville. Down in front of it. Score! Jacob Trouba and the Winnipeg Jets have tied the game up 3-3. Liney again, right by Shaw. Score! Dustin Byfuglien has given the Jets a 4-3 lead. For Scheifele, big save. Reba, score! Blake Wheeler! And the captain has the Jets in front 5-4. Lowry gets it for Brandon Tanev. Tanev at the empty net. Tanev delays. Scores! And Brandon Tanev has scored in four straight games. Another empty netter. And the Jets have a 7-4 lead. And they will take a 2-1 lead in a terrific comeback in a game where they trailed 3-0 after one period.
The day after, the night before. Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL This Week. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Sean Assor and Ezra Ginsberg. You can reach us here in studio via Twitter. At Legal Curve is where you can find us on Twitter. If you want to reach us via text message, we also accept you that way. You can send your text to 1290.90. Standard messaging rates do apply. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, good evening to you both. It's now been, well, about 20 hours, give or take, since that game last night ended in what was an epic contest at Bell MTS Place. Certainly didn't start the way that the hometown fans would have wanted, but 40 minutes later, 40 minutes after a disappointing first period, 40 minutes of playing time, that is, it was an epic party with a celebration last night. A 7-4 Winnipeg Jets victory, taking a 2-1 series lead, winning yet again on home ice.
It was the best Jets game in 2.0 history.
Whoa.
And arguably the best night in the history of the city of Winnipeg.
That's a bold statement for somebody who's 35 years old.
It was right up there, Drew. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, the Jets had the horrible start to the game. And I think, guys, if Austin Watson doesn't make it 3-0 in that first period, you know, it's 2-0. And then you're thinking, okay, it's not as bad. The Jets only have to come back and tie this game up. They only have to get 2 goals here. But, you know, Austin Watson squeaks one through Connor Hellebuck. And that's when he would want to have back. We all know that. He wasn't good in the first period, but right after Paul Stastny scores and then Austin Watson goes after Blake Wheeler and then Mark Scheifele jumps in, I mean, the complexion of that game changed. And, you know, the Jets were not going to be denied, starting with Dustin Byfuglien and then Jacob Trouba's goal that tied it up, Shawnee. But I thought that the Jets did a really good job of not letting that 3-goal disadvantage affect them. They didn't change their game at all, and I actually thought that they were pretty good in that first period. I mean, sure, the Predators were the better team. One of the goals was a weak goal.
They could say even probably two of the goals.
Say two of the goals were weak goals, but, you know, I thought that the Jets did some good things in that first period, and, you know, they responded, and I think we've seen that time and time again this year. I mean, the Jets have been down, whether it's 1 goal, 2 goals, 3 goals, they're not out of a game, and, you know, give them a lot of credit for sticking with it. That's what you heard from all the players, whether it was Blake Wheeler or, you know, Josh Morrissey, and, you know, the Jets have a really good opportunity to go up here 3-1, and if they do go up 3-1, Sean, we know that this series is most likely over.
Yeah, hold on. Let me just unravel my 5 meters of scrolls worth of topics to discuss from last night, because if you aren't a fan of the game of hockey, or you just aren't, haven't been exposed to the game of hockey, I suggest you sit down, watch last night's game, and if you don't like the game of hockey after that, well, maybe hockey just isn't for you, because that was as amazing a hockey game as you could ask for. And after a pretty disappointing first round in general across the NHL postseason, the second round has come out full force, league-wide. It has been incredible. And last night what we witnessed at Bell MTS Place was something for the ages. I mean, is it as simple as a switch between Kyle Connor and Nikolaj Ehlers? Maybe. Is it Mark Scheifele defending Blake Wheeler after a vicious hit to the head? Maybe. Is it the Jets remaining calm in the first, according to Paul Stastny, saying we just need to chip away and do what we do best? Maybe. But all things considered, not the greatest game from Connor Hellebuyck to start, and the Jets rallied, and what we saw was something special.
I'll tell you one thing. What didn't that game have? Sorry, Drew. I mean, you think about it. I mean, it had lead changes. We had a fight between Jacob Trouba and Nick Bonino. I mean, you had open ice hitting. You had goals coming at a furious pace. I mean, we talked about it. Three goals in under 3 minutes. And going ahead into game four, you wonder if Paul Maurice is going to stick with Nikolaj Ehlers on that top line and then keep Kyle Connor with Patrick Laine on that second line. You know, so we'll
with
see.
With Paul Stastny.
Yeah. So,
well, we'll talk about that all over the next, you know, 30, 45 minutes or thereabouts. The one thing that you didn't say, Shawnee, when you were running through those, you know, different sort of turning points or pivotal events during last night's game is the Mike Fisher hitting the crossbar late in the first period and Philip Forsberg hitting the post early in the second period. Because if the Predators are able to make that a four-goal lead, I think four goals is almost insurmountable most often. More often than not, four goals is insurmountable. Three goals and you still have a glimmer of hope. Not that you ever want to go down three goals, but in this day and age, and we were talking about this last night as he up in the press box after the game, in this day and age with the way the game is being called in the NHL, when you have an offense like the Winnipeg Jets, which you can say is an offensive juggernaut, one of the best goal-scoring teams in the league, with the way the game is enforced and the way the game is officiated, where there isn't clutching and grabbing and there isn't really the stick work that you used to be able to get away with, where stick infractions are called and penalties are assessed for it, a team like the Jets, who has the offense behind them, can stage a comeback. And I certainly think that, you know, the one that everyone's pointing to, the turning point of Austin Watson going after Wheeler and then Scheifele coming in, and some initially you'd say, well, that's a foolish play by Scheifele.
Blake Wheeler said in postgame, he said he was not happy about it right off the
hop. Scheifele, you know, all of a sudden goes from being a Jets power play to a four-on-four situation. I mean, the way the Jets played that four-on-four, Austin Watson really did look like he awakened the sleeping beast in the Jets. And as impressive as the Jets' play was in that four-on-four, what I think Peter Laviolette has to be equally upset about is just how awful the Predators played in that four-on-four situation. Their D-zone coverage was horrendous. I mean, Jacob Trouba on the tying goal leads the rush in, and you're going to be able to get a clean zone entry because there's only, you know, four guys. You know, it's four-on-four hockey. Mm-hmm. Clean zone entries should be reasonable. But to completely lose coverage of him and allow him to really enter the zone, pass off the puck, and walk around to the net to be unmarked is just a damning testament to how the Predators played in that four-on-four situation.
Absolutely. In that game, I almost thought that the Predators were too preoccupied with the physicality in that game and they were too passive.
How concerned would you guys be with the lack of discipline shown by the Nashville Predators during the game? It's a 4-3 Jets lead after 40 minutes. Predators tie it up after Roslovic takes that interference penalty and Philip Forsberg, you know, picks the corner, and it's 4-all. Anybody's game still. The Jets have staged their epic comeback. The Predators have punched back to tie the game. It's 4-all, and then the Predators take three penalties in the final, you know, in a 5 or 6 minute span with under 10 minutes to play in the game. How concerning is that lack of composure to you?
The Predators were the most penalized team in the league during the regular season, and it's definitely something I think that Peter Laviolette has to be concerned about, especially when Pekka Rinne takes that penalty and they're only down by a goal. So it was absolutely a problem in this game.
It's just, you look at some of the penalties that they were taking. I'm thinking specifically, you know, the Colton Sissons penalty where he slams Nikolaj Ehlers against the boards and then throws him to the ice. The hit wasn't called. The slam to the ice was called. So it's just, it's maybe a little bit of frustration creeping into their game. Like, as he mentioned, we saw the Pekka Rinne slash where Adam Lowry doesn't really egregiously slash him. It's not that tough of a slash. He taps him on the hands and he takes the outside route. He could have taken the inside, even initiated even more contact, but he goes around. And then just the swinging hacksaw Jim Duggan 2x4. If that's a smaller player, that could be a slash to the neck or head. Peter Laviolette, also, you saw a little bit of frustration through him after a couple non-calls were made and the Jets were able to score. He lost his cool on the bench, maybe kind of deferring or deflecting away from his players a little bit, but he lost it on the referees on the bench. And it's concerning when you see some of the, I don't know how much, have the Predators really faced a lot of adversity this season?
probably not to the extent of the adversity they're currently facing, being down 2-1 to the Jets. You know, in the first round, they didn't play very well, but they were fortunate in that they played a much weaker opponent in the Colorado Avalanche. Right now, the Predators, after three games, have to be concerned with the tone of the series. I think they have to be concerned with their response to some of the physicality. I mean, Ezzie, you mentioned this sort of in your answer before about the Predators being too preoccupied with the physical side of the game. Are the Jets inside the Predators' head after three games?
It's possible, but the reality is, guys, I mean, these two teams are so evenly matched. This series could easily be 2-1 Predators right now.
Sure, well, they're up 3-0 in the first game. It's just, you know, it's something switched. I mean, it's so bizarre to see a team, you know, how do you explain, and I don't literally mean explain, but how do you explain the Nashville Predators just stop playing after the, you know, 2-minute mark?
Well, that's what they all said, but the reality is, guys, when the Jets are coming in waves, I mean, we know this team has three good scoring lines, and when Matty Perreault is back in the lineup, they have four good scoring lines. So, I mean, it's not like the Predators weren't trying out there or they weren't actually moving. I mean, give the Jets a lot of credit. I mean, they came out and they made some adjustments and, you know, it worked.
When we come back, we'll talk more about last night's Jets-Predators game. We'll talk about the return, the imminent return, apparently, of Matty Perreault to the Jets lineup. And we'll talk about the influence that Dustin Byfuglien has had on the series. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Well, it's funny because we talked about Blake Wheeler being the emotional bellwether of the Winnipeg Jets, and that's certainly the case. But when Big Buff is on, and he was on in this hockey game, my goodness. And to get that goal, the first of two in 18 seconds, and then for him to be involved in the offense the way that he was, make things happen and get that goal, and then just the dancing. You got to love Big Buff dancing. And stepping up on Arvidsson. Arvidsson saw that train coming and got out of the way. The hits, the dancing, the goals, the assists. I mean, full meal deal for Dustin Byfuglien.
TSN Hockey Insider Bob McKenzie speaking last night about the role, the impact of Big Buff number 33 for the Winnipeg Jets. Dustin Byfuglien with a whale of a game last night, getting two goals and an assist, a three-point game for Byfuglien. He moves up to tied for the most points by a defenseman in these playoffs, tied with Torrey Krug and John Carlson. Both Krug and Carlson have played a game more than Dustin Byfuglien has. Welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for over 30 years. That's a really long time. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Canadian Press, he's their national hockey writer. We're pleased to be joined by Joshua Clipperton. Joshua, good evening. Thanks very much for joining us. How are you doing?
Good, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. We always love having you on. Josh, you're actually here in town covering the Jets and the Predators for the Canadian Press. How was your first experience? I presume it was your first experience, at least, with the whiteout last night.
Yeah, you're right. It definitely was my first experience, and it was definitely something to see in person for the first time. I was really impressed with the crowd. I think there was a lot of nerves early, players and fans alike, but we all know how it turned around, so it was a pretty incredible experience.
Joshua, you know, you mentioned the nerves early and then how that game turned around. I mean, you know, 3-0 Predators right off the start, and you know, it used to be a 3-0 lead in the NHL was somewhat insurmountable. This year, with the new rules in place that, you know, don't allow for any of the stick fouls and don't allow for really any of the clutching and grabbing and the things that sort of take away a team's speed, is that sort of also part of, like, you know, the Jets obviously are tremendously talented, but do the new rules play a role in a team not being able just to sit back and sort of shut it down in order to try and preserve a lead, and you almost are forced to always press?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably part of it. You look at how how the game sort of played out yesterday. I mean, there, you know, two of those goals were 4-on-4, so you know, structure does sort of go out the window a little bit in those situations. But yeah, I mean, I think these two teams especially are both they put the pedal to the metal. I mean, they were both top 10 in goals scored. I mean, you know, obviously the Jets were second in the regular season. I think Nashville was tied for seventh, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, they got a lot of firepower. But, yeah, you're right. The ability of players to go through the neutral zone without being impeded the way they were in the dead puck era and even, you know, 5-10 years ago, it makes a huge difference. We get to see, you know, the speed, you know, their attack. Guys are moving back and forth. You know, it's not just straight-line hockey like we were used to in years past. So, yeah, no, definitely the NHL's you know, clamp down on some of the stick fouls makes a big difference. And, you know, we saw the fruits of that last night.
Now, Josh, sticking with the fouls, P.K. Subban is in the penalty box when Blake Wheeler scores the game's winning goal. Shortly before that, Kevin Fiala took a penalty, and then shortly after P.K. Subban came out of the penalty box, Pekka Rinne took that slashing penalty. If you're Peter Laviolette, how concerned are you with Nashville's discipline right now?
Well, you know what? I'm sure it was the talking point today, because that was not what a veteran team that was in the Stanley Cup final last year. That's not how they're you know, expected to act. I thought it was interesting on PK's penalty, especially. He was upset. I think he like thought that Ehlers maybe sold it a little bit. I mean, he obviously made contact, but he should have been mad at himself for not clearing the puck twice in a row. Right before that, at the end of the previous penalty. So I mean, I'm sure that the Predators are looking to clean up multiple things in their game. I mean, their composure being one of them, the penalties. I mean, you know, we talk about the Jets' comeback, but, you know, the Predators came back and again and tied it, and they were 4-4 with 10 minutes to go, and then they take three straight penalties. I mean, that's not going to get it done, especially against a potent power play like the Jets have. I mean, eventually they were going to capitalize. So I'm sure that was a point of emphasis. I'm sure Peter Laviolette is concerned about that, and I'm sure it was talked about today and will probably be talked about again tomorrow.
Josh, we talked to Blake Wheeler after the game, and he called Dustin Byfuglien the great equalizer. I'm curious, from your perspective, what have you seen from the big man, number 33, and just the way he's been able to impact not only this series, but just the playoffs in general?
Yeah, I mean, last night was a throwback game for him. I mean, I saw the Dustin Byfuglien. I think a lot of us in the media saw the Dustin Byfuglien of 2010 with the Chicago Blackhawks, and the way that he just controlled the play then, you know, he was unstoppable. I remember a series against, in that run, you know, the series against the Canucks and other opponents, that he was just, you know, he was a man possessed. And last night was another one of those performances. I mean, you look at the goals, timely goals, you know, a few of his hits were pretty bone shattering. I mean, you look at Victor Arvidsson, just narrowly got out of the way. Could have been a Scott Stevens Kozlov type of moment along the boards there in the third period. I think that he brings everyone plays a few inches taller when he's in the lineup, because no one's going to challenge him, and you can really see how the Jets responded to him. I mean, and you talk about you know, a physical response. Mark Scheifele going after Austin Watson after he took a run at Blake Wheeler. I mean, those types of physical responses make a big difference, but definitely Byfuglien's presence, you know, offensively, defensively, and physically was really important yesterday for Winnipeg.
You're listening to NHL This Week. Our guest is Joshua Clipperton of the Canadian Press. He's their national hockey writer. We're talking about the Jets and the Predators, the second round series. The Jets lead 2-1. Joshua, coming into the series, you know, we heard a lot about the Predators' defense and their top four, you know, obviously Josi and Subban and Ekholm and Ellis and how great they are. The Jets' defense was much less talked about, especially the right side defense, which is, you know, pretty good with Byfuglien and Trouba and Myers. Do you think that the Jets' right side defense was maybe a little overlooked? Maybe the Jets' defense as a whole was maybe overlooked a little bit entering this series?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I think that's just the nature of it. When you have four guys that are viewed by many on the Predators as probably being number one or close to it on another team, but, you know, the Jets have a solid core themselves. I mean, we just talked about Byfuglien, obviously, but I know that Myers, you know, came back this year after all of injury trouble last year. I'm really impressed with Josh Morrissey on the left side as well. I remember going to rookie camp in Penticton more than a couple of years ago now when he was there. When I was out in Vancouver covering the Canucks and chatting with him and just being really impressed with his maturity, and then again talking to him today, you know, he hasn't really changed a whole lot. It's just a guy who's just a pro's pro, and you could tell, you know, when he was 17, 18, 19 years old, Not that he's that much older now, but yeah, I think that the Jets defense, you know, we talk about, you know, all the scoring, but I mean, there's a reason that Connor Hellebuyck is in the Vezina conversation. I mean, obviously he played well, but you got to have guys in front of you, you know, cleaning things up. And you know, I think that maybe the Jets defense was a little overlooked, but I mean, you can understand when the guys on the other side are the names like Yossi, Subban, you know, Ellis and Ekholm.
Josh, moving away from the Jets-Predators series here for a second, you live in Toronto now. You used to be in Vancouver, of course. The big news coming out this week that Lou Lamoriello is not going to be returning as the Leafs GM. How long before the Leafs make it official and announce that Kyle Dubas is going to be the team's new GM?
Well, you know, it was really strange that they didn't announce it when they announced that Lou wasn't coming back. I mean, if this is the succession plan as they claim, it strikes me as odd that they wouldn't name him. I'm assuming that they're going to. I mean, it doesn't sound like there's too many other candidates. I feel like you would have heard other names bandied about. Of course, Mark Hunter is there. So yeah, I mean, it could be any day. I mean, but I also was surprised that it wasn't right away. I think a lot of people were kind of taken caught off guard a little bit that it wasn't made official right away, but I think he's the guy, and it sounds like he's the guy. I mean, this is the whole Shanna plan that's been put in place 3 years ago. But it'll be interesting because, you know, Kyle Dukes is only 31 years old. You know, he's got an $8 million coach behind the bench. It's going to be an interesting transition if and when it does happen.
And if it does go to Dubas, what happens with Mark Hunter? Does he just, his role remain the same, or is he elevated, or what goes on with him?
Well, that's a big question, Mark. I mean, the Leafs don't let you talk to their assistant general managers under any circumstances except at the draft. So we haven't talked to Mark Hunter in a long time. So who knows exactly what he's feeling? I mean, I'm not sure what happens. I mean, if you're an assistant GM and the other assistant GM gets promoted, do you want to work for that assistant GM who's now your boss? I mean, I don't know. I don't really know the ins and outs of their relationship, but Mark Hunter's obviously older than Kyle Dubas, more experienced. So it'll be interesting. You know, he's a draftist. He's their draft guy. He's responsible for a lot of the picks that they've brought in and guys that are in their system. So he's been pretty valuable for them. So it'd be tough to lose him. But you know, that'll be an interesting sort of side note if and when Kyle Dubas does become the Leafs' next GM.
Now, Josh, sticking with the GM news, what do you make of Ron Francis's contract being terminated? Rick Dudley's in now. It's a really bizarre sequence of events, isn't it, there in Carolina?
Yeah, it's strange. It seems like it's the upside down down in Carolina with the way they're sort of handling things. I mean, obviously, Tom Dundon's come in and has you know, made his mark in how he wants to run things. I think that it's soured a few people in the hockey world with how some of these guys have been treated. It's definitely a different way of doing things. I'm willing to give Dundon the benefit of the doubt, though, because, you know, when you miss the playoffs as much as the Carolina Hurricanes have, and you have, and you have your own way of doing things, at least in terms of a business model, you know, maybe it's time for something different there. I mean, it's definitely unique, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But, I mean, we've also seen meddlesome owners in other sports. I mean, of course, we all follow the CFL and how there's been ownership issues in that league in the past with owners trying to, you know, get their hands into all parts of the organization. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But it's definitely a unique situation, I'll say, when it comes to the Carolina Hurricanes right now. And we'll just have to see how the Dudley situation play. I mean, with him coming in, and then they haven't hired his boss yet, which is such a strange way of going about things.
So what you're saying, Josh, was you don't want the Gliebermans to all of a sudden become co-owners of the Carolina Hurricanes.
Well, as a former Ottawa guy, I'm from there. I definitely lived through those years, so I would hope for the Hurricanes fan base that's not the case. So.
Josh, we'll let you go on this last question, shifting back to the Jets-Preds series. Pekka-Rinne in the three games of the series, taking away empty net goals, has given up 3, 4, and 5 goals respectively in each game. If you're the Predators, are you concerned with the play of Pekka-Rinne?
You know, I don't really think so. I mean, you think about some of the chances the Jets had the other night. I mean, they could have had more. Blake Wheeler himself could have had 3 before he even scored that winner in the final, you know, five minutes of the game. I don't think that Rinne's played poorly. I think that, I mean, he could obviously maybe he probably want a couple of them back, but I mean, that's any goalie. So I don't think I'm overly concerned about that. I think they just have to play better as a team and play smarter. I mean, like 5-on-5, the Predators really have been okay. I think it's 7-6 in terms of 5-on-5 play in favor of Nashville right now. Goals for and against in the series. So, I mean, they just need to sort of stay with the penalty box and just sort of bear down a little bit. And then that, saying that, I think the Jets need to do the same thing in terms of bearing down. I mean, they can't have a start like they did yesterday because, you know, I really don't think that the Predators are going to let another 3-0 lead up in the first period if it happens again.
Game 4 between the Jets and the Predators goes tomorrow evening at Bell MTS Place. Joshua Clipperton will be there for the Canadian press. Josh, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Fun. Anytime.
We'll do it again soon. Thanks a lot, Josh. When we come back, we look at a couple of the other playoff series underway. The Bruins and the Lightning are playing Game 3 right now. The Golden Knights and the Sharks will play Game 4 later on tonight. Talk about those two series up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Wild Bill Carlson, William Carlson of the Vegas Golden Knights, getting the overtime winner as they lead the San Jose Sharks 2-1, game 4 of that series going later tonight. You know, it's sort of funny, the other series have been great, Sean. You sort of referenced that the first round was relatively lousy.
No, let's talk about that. The second round has been far better than the first round. Like, it's not even close. Every series in the second round has been great so far.
It's compelling hockey.
You got Tampa Bay up 3-1 right now in Boston. It's the first period still.
In game three, they're up 3-1. Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
All four series are tied.
Yeah.
I mean, this series has been great. We know the Lightning and the Bruins, two of the top teams in the Eastern Conference. The Jets-Predator series, I think, has been the best of the four series. Oh, Golden yeah. Knight Sharks, you've already had two overtimes.
Mm-hmm.
In the first three games. I mean, the other series hasn't been bad either. Pittsburgh and Washington. You've got Washington up 2-1. I mean, that game almost went to overtime yesterday.
Yeah,
I mean, every series is compelling and the hockey's been great.
And I think the reason is you have four series where there's no clear-cut favorite in any of the four series. Like, you know, before the series started, you would have said,
yep, I agree with that.
Okay, you know, Vegas, San Jose. Well, I can see Vegas winning, you know, if these couple things happen, but if these other couple things happen, I can see San Jose winning. And you go down the line series by series, and you say that. It's just, right now you have eight evenly matched teams that it's almost, you know, if these teams played probably, you know, 15 times, one team wins eight games, the other team wins seven games. That's how close, that's how competitive these games have been, and that's made for an absolutely fantastic second round. And the Golden Knights, you know, have that 2-1 lead. I mean, that shot by William Carlson is an incredible shot. I mean, that's a goal scorer shot.
Yeah, and they're obviously picking that side on Marc-Andre Fleury. Mm-hmm. And
Martin,
you know,
Jones.
Pardon me, Martin Jones. Yeah. Marc-Andre Fleury obviously plays for the Golden Knights, yeah. So it'd be weird if he was scoring on his own goaltender.
He's doing everything else.
But Sean, isn't this an argument, the second round, isn't this an argument for keeping the playoff format the same?
It's funny you say that, because I was thinking that as we were introing all
the second round is the new first round. It really is. The first round used to be the most exciting round. Now it's the second round.
Yeah, but
am I wrong there?
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily a hard and fast rule. I mean, it might be an anomaly this year.
The two sweeps also.
This year, the wild card teams.
Second round was better last year. Remember the Anaheim-Edmonton series?
Yeah, that was great.
That
but
was
I mean,
series.
The first round.
Pittsburgh-Washington last year?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's something to be said for your argument. I think the wild card teams were just a step below the other teams in this year's.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
In this year's series. I mean,
yeah, Toronto took Washington to six games, almost took them to seven games, but this year we saw two sweeps.
Yeah.
In the first round, and we saw a couple series only go five games.
And, you know, maybe Minnesota, you get, even though they finished third in the division, maybe they get an asterisk next to their name because of all the injuries they suffered late in the year. But nobody really thought of Philadelphia or New Jersey as serious threats for the Stanley Cup. Nobody thought Colorado in the West as a wild card team as a serious threat. But that all these teams, the eight teams that are still in it, you can definitely make an argument that any of these eight teams could eventually win the Stanley Cup.
Like, Drew, my question is, why does it matter when Pittsburgh and Washington play? I think I've changed my tune a little bit here.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't necessarily think that the playoff format is perfect, Sean, but I mean, you're going to see Pittsburgh and Washington probably. If you don't see them in the second round, you're going to see them in the third round. If you don't see Winnipeg and Nashville in the second round, you're going to see them in the third round.
Sure.
So why does it really matter?
And
I think it creates good rivalry.
That's been the argument that a lot of people have made. And I would suggest the only – and Paul Maurice was asked this question the other day. I guess that would have been – I think it was even yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Before, you know, in his sort of pregame scrum or in the after practice, they were – you know, the conversation about and asked about the playoff format. And he said right now he doesn't have a problem with it. The only time he'd have a problem with it is if it ended up where, let's say, the fifth-place team in one of the divisions doesn't get in as – or I guess it would be a sixth-place team in one of the divisions doesn't get in because they're the sixth-place team in that division, and they – even though they would be better than the third-place team in the opposite division, that there's only one crossover possibility, not two crossover possibilities.
Sean, doesn't it come down to whether you want to see these series earlier rather than later? I mean – I get it. I mean, Winnipeg and Nashville should probably be the conference final. But it's been an amazing series that we're getting to see earlier.
I got some breaking news coming for you guys right
Exciting.
Now. NHL Department of Player Safety has just suspended Washington's Tom Wilson. You guys want to guess?
I just saw it, so.
You guys both just saw it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sean, I'm gonna guess
three games.
I just saw it on Twitter as well.
Yeah. You too have the internet in front of you.
We just completely buzzkilled Drew's news
there. Three-game suspension for Tom Wilson for his hit to the head on Zach Aston-Reese last night. And
a little surprised by that.
Well, I want to talk about that more because we're going to talk about that coming up at 7:15 because we're going to be joined by Seth Rohrabaugh at 7:30 to talk about that series. But I wanted to get the news out there while we're on air.
He does have a suspension history.
He does have a history, but it's funny with this hit, and we'll talk about it much more in depth in a little bit. A lot of players in the league came out and said this was a clean body check that had a bad result, and should we be suspending somebody for a clean hit that has a bad result attached to it?
Well, and I know you want to get into this next hour, Drew, but remember, I mean, a lot of people, namely, you know, the Pittsburgh Penguins thought maybe he should be suspended for his hit in game one on Brian Dumoulin, right?
Absolutely.
So maybe they're giving him an extra game or two because they didn't give him anything for that hit on Brian Dumoulin. I don't know. Three games, that surprises me. I don't think he should have got three games.
Spin the wheel of roulette for the NHL Department of Player Safety. But let's go back to the series that we were talking about before. The Golden Knights, Sharks, that's a huge game tonight for San Jose at home. I don't think that they, if they go back to Vegas down 3-1, they're really in a hole, just like the Predators will be in a hole if they go back to Nashville 3-1 and or down 3-1. This is a huge game for San Jose tonight. And right now, you know, Tampa Bay, after a sluggish game one where they really were badly outplayed by a tired Boston Bruins team, is playing very well in as that series shifts to Boston right now. The Lightning up 3-1 on the Bruins early in the first period in that game.
Yeah, and, you know, sticking with the, you know, starting, I should say, with the Sharks and Golden Knights series, I mean, you know, the Sharks have to win this game. It's in their home arena. And as you mentioned, Drew, I mean, we know what the odds are of coming back from a 3-1 deficit. It's basically if you go up 3-1, you have a 90% chance, or 90% of the teams have won the series. But we're going to see some changes here. I mean, I don't know if Joe Thornton's going to be in the lineup for San Jose, but Paul Martin is out. Joachim Ryan hasn't played a playoff game yet this year, and he's going in for Paul Martin. Paul Martin has not been good in the series, and we know that Paul Martin, you know, he obviously didn't play a full year with the Sharks, but also, I mean, Jonas Donskoy did not play for the Sharks last game. He's injured right now, and what they did was they moved Chris Tierney up a line, and they had Barclay Goodrow centering that third line, and that third line really got exposed by the Vegas Golden Knights.
It's a bad time to get injuries for the San Jose Sharks. They don't have the depth like, you know, the Winnipeg Jets, if you want to use that, them as an example, where they can plug guys into their lineup who would typically be, you know, in the starting 12 or among the 12 forwards for another team. So the Sharks really up against the eight ball tonight as they look to even that series on home ice.
Yeah, Shawnee, and, you know, I'll let you get in here. What they actually did, what Pete DeBoer did there is he actually moved up Logan Couture and created a super line. It was Joe Pavelski, Evander Kane, and Logan Couture towards the end of that game. And, you know, we have to talk about, you know, the save that Marc-Andre Fleury makes in overtime. I mean, San Jose could have easily been up 2-1 in the series. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, Vegas possibly going up 3-1, but this has been a very even series. Two games have gone to overtime. And let's be honest here. I mean, the William Karlsson, Jonathan Marchessault, O'Reilly Smith line, what are they on, 5 and 6 game point streaks, I think, with Riley Smith and William Karlsson? I mean, that Vegas top line, not only did they dominate L.A., they're dominating San Jose right now. And, you know, let's be honest, Martin Jones has not been good.
We talk about exposure and how much fun the playoffs is to kind of learn about different players that we don't get to see a lot quickly. Riley Smith is extremely impressive. He's a player.
Very underrated.
And we talk a lot about William Karlsson, and you know, Dan Duva has come on numerous times and said, ISO cam William Karlsson when you watch him, and he's an impressive player. I've been doing that, and he's absolutely right. This guy is, he's a workhorse, and he doesn't lose battles along the wall. And then we played the clip, and you talked about the shots. I mean, that shot was crazy.
Yeah. Fantastic hockey being played all throughout the second round. Tonight, the Sharks and the Golden Knights, that's game four.
Must win for San Jose.
Must win for San Jose. The Lightning up after 20 minutes on the Bruins. They're up 3-1, a game where they can steal home ice advantage back from Boston after Boston won it in game one in Tampa. That series is going to be, well, it already is a dogfight, and it's only going to continue to get better. When we come back, the Atlanta Thrashers have been revived in Carolina. It's not necessarily a good thing, but we're going to find out right from the source. The source is Corey Lavallette. He covers the Carolina Hurricanes for the North State Journal. He joins us next to discuss all the moves being made by the Carolina Hurricanes. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome to the program Corey Lavallette. Corey covers the Carolina Hurricanes for the North State Journal in Raleigh. Corey, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure, Corey. Obviously brought you on to talk about the Hurricanes. It's sort of been an off-season of upheaval in Carolina that sort of continued this week with the news that, you know, Rick Dudley is now a member of the Hurricanes front office. Ron Francis has had his, you know, contract terminated. Joe Neuwendijk is leaving the team. Don Waddell is still there playing a key role. You know, it's hard to figure out what sort of path the Carolina Hurricanes are on right now, especially as it pertains to sort of who's running the ship.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting situation. I thought you guys were going to ask me for my expertise on the two coaches in the series you guys have called.
Yeah, Corey, are you actually related to Peter Laviolette?
I'm not. I don't have the IO. The interesting part is I grew up in Massachusetts, and he went to college in the town over from where I grew up in. So I mentioned that to him. That was kind of funny. But he's a Eastern Mass guy. I'm a Western Mass guy. But pretty interesting offseason thus far. I think everyone expected it to be different and exciting and interesting, and it has been so far. The Ron news this week, I don't think was a huge surprise to anyone. He was pretty much out of the loop, so to speak, once he was kicked upstairs and had his GM duties taken away. He had been working from home even on draft stuff. So I'm not surprised that they just decided to part ways. And, you know, Ron's a classy guy, and he's not going to speak badly about anyone. He really hasn't been visible, at all since that initial change was made. And Don Waddell has been, Don, as far as we know now, is not a candidate to be the full-time GM, but, certainly he played a part in getting Rick Dudley there. Those two have a long history together, and Dudley's, For all the talk that we've heard lately of nobody in hockey wants to work for Tom Dundon, I think you're not going to find somebody who's worked more in hockey than Rick Dudley. So, I think he's a good addition for sure. And I know still lots to be done. You know, coach, a GM, a number two draft pick. There's plenty of decisions to be made.
Now, Corey, you just mentioned, you know, the Hurricanes still have to hire a GM and a coach. What comes first? Does the most, you know, does it make logical sense that Rick Dudley and Don Waddell hire a general manager first and then bring in a coach? Or is there a possibility that they hire a coach first and then bring in a general manager?
The thing that's fun to me about all this is the guy that I look at and I say, man, he would be good at either job is Mike Vellucci, who's down in Charlotte. And, you know, obviously Vellucci has a, you know, Mike's got a long track record of being a GM, a successful GM in the OHL with Plymouth and being a coach, there. And then he's had a great year in his first year in Charlotte, and he's been assistant GM here for a few years also. From what I understand, everyone seems to be saying he'd rather be coaching again. And to me, he might be an ideal candidate because the guys who have come up from Charlotte this year and it took too long for them to come up, and it came up kind of after things were already set and done. Valentin Zhikov had a fantastic year. And Warren Fogle, you know, kind of came out of nowhere and I don't think it was a surprise that he had a good year in the AHL, but for him to have as good of a year as he did, having, you know, almost no power play time and playing on the penalty kill as a rookie and scoring as much as he did, I think, you know, Mike is a guy that could fall into either of those spots. So that decision could be made without a GM. I don't know. This is going to be a different structure than we've seen before. And while everyone is kind of up in arms about that, I don't know that it's going to be that much different from what it is in Toronto with, you know, where they were with Lamoriello and Hunter and Dubas and all that. It's just that it might not be the names that Toronto had, and that's to be understood. I mean, Toronto's got an endless amount of money to throw at people.
You know, Corey, just going back to Ron Francis and what's happened here, I mean, back in March, Ron Francis is demoted, and then a couple of months later, he's terminated, and obviously they bring Rick Dudley in here, but what happened there? Was this just a disagreement between Tom Dundon and Ron Francis? Why wasn't he terminated back in March?
Yeah, you know, I'm not totally clear on what exactly happened there. And like I said, Ron's been, I think he will continue to be pretty tight-lipped. He was tight-lipped as a GM, and I think he's going to, you know, kind of go quietly into the night, so to speak, as far as what happened here. Everything I've been told about Tom and when I spoke to him, they say you can take him at his word. And when I spoke to Tom, he said it was just a matter of personalities not working out. And I don't think that meant necessarily arguments. I think it was just they're different guys. Tom's a pretty intense guy and, wants results. And Ron has been very patient here. And I don't think anybody can say Ron didn't leave the team better than he found it because, Carolina's farm system now is much better than it was. They held on to draft picks. It's, you know, I always, whenever I talk to anybody about this, I'm like, Jim Rutherford's done a fantastic job in Pittsburgh, but a couple years down the road, and certainly you do this to win two Stanley Cups and, you know, you're working on trying to get to a third here. But you look at what he's done to do that, and he's pillaged the system and traded, you know, traded draft picks and not really kept that end of it up. And he did that in Carolina, but instead of trying to win cups in Carolina, he was trying to do it just to get into the playoffs. So Ron did a really good job at all that. But, I think it's just, like I said, Tom, from what I understand, can be taken at his word. And it was just one of those things that I think maybe they didn't think things needed to be done in the same fashion as, one thing to consider certainly is with Ron, there were no leaks. I mean, you didn't know anything the Hurricanes were going to do until it happened. And we've seen already that there's a little bit more of a leaky ship right now under Tom Dundon. And, you know, that's a tactic. I don't think that, you know, I don't think there's necessarily a ton of people saying, oh, I'm going to undercut this guy. There's plenty of teams that leak things. And I think it was maybe that's one tactic that they're utilizing that they didn't use under Ron is if, you know, they've been very vocal about, oh, it's the number two pick. I don't know that they'll do that. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to do that unless there's a huge payoff for it. But I think they're willing to maybe rock the ball a little more and leaking things out and getting information out there and seeing how people react to it.
Corey, we here in Winnipeg, of course, know the sheer elation that comes with winning a draft lottery, i.e. Patrick Laine. The Hurricanes move from 11th to 2nd this year. That's a huge moment for the franchise. Any idea what direction they'll go with the pick?
I mean, I think you've got to look at Svechnikov. I mean, they need a big guy that can just create offense. Sebastian Aho, they tried him a little bit at center. I think that they think that's where his future is. And if there was, you know, if there was a big time center to be taken in this draft, then maybe that plan shifts and you keep Sebastian Aho at the wing. But I think with now, you know, a really impressive group of wingers here, and they really, in my mind, you can't go wrong with either of the three forwards after Dahlin. With, you know, Svechnikov's obviously, I think, the consensus number two guy right now. Philip Zadina played with Martin Nečas for the Czech team in the World Juniors, and they had great chemistry, and Nečas will be in North America next year. And it looks like a really promising prospect as well. And he could play in the middle also, down the road. That's the plan. And then, you know, Tkachuk is the kind of guy that the Hurricanes haven't had in, I mean, you could really say forever. They haven't had a nasty power forward type really ever. And, that, I mean, I think that's one of the things you're going to see with this, change in ownership, change in management is this team's going to, they spoke at length about how they need to be tougher to play against, how they need to be, you know, more difficult on a night-to-night basis. And a guy like Tkachuk could bring that too. So, there are, you know, I don't think you can go wrong in any of those spots. At the same time, I think Svechnikov's a guy that's a game changer. You know, I think everybody would love to get Dahlin, but the Hurricanes defense isn't lacking, so to speak, especially on the left side. So, it really could have, the only way it could have gone better would have been to get the first overall pick, but that second pick looks pretty good right now too.
You know, Corey, as Sean mentioned, getting the number two overall pick is absolutely huge. The Jets getting Patrick Laine, I mean, that changed the face of the franchise, even though they won't get Rasmus Dahlin. They're going to get a really good player, whether that's, you know, Svechnikov or, you know, another player, Brady Tkachuk. But when you look at, you know, the Carolina Hurricanes right now, I think that you would agree that they're not just one or two players away from being a Stanley Cup contender. Whoever the Carolina Hurricanes bring in as general manager, Rick Dudley and Don Waddell bring in as general manager, is their draft philosophy going to be a huge part of that? And how important is drafting going to be for this franchise? Because as we talked about, I mean, this is a team that has a lot of moves to make, and they're a long way away from being a really good team.
Yeah, I mean, I think the good news is you have so many young assets that if they decide they want to do something and shake things up, they can do that. You know, like I said, the defense, there's so many pieces there. I think Jacob Slavin and Brett Pesce are here to stay. But Noah Hannafin and Justin Falk, you know, could both be the options, you know, especially with Jake being, you know, turning pro next year. At forward, you've got a bunch of guys there that are, you know, there's not a huge game changer among them, but there's plenty of guys there that are young and can make a difference. And with Jeff Skinner entering the last year of his contract this year, you know, he could have played his last game, with the Hurricanes. I don't know that, with the coaching change, perhaps they give Jeff another run, because it didn't seem like he was maybe best utilized under Bill Peters, but Jeff Skinner is obviously a huge piece that they could move either in the off season or if they look like they're on the outside of the playoffs again this year, certainly at the deadline, he will get a huge payback.
Corey, we'll let you go on this last question. We're joined by Corey Lavallette of the North Star Journal talking about the Carolina Hurricanes. You know, when Tom Dundon came in as the new owner, you know, there was excitement around it. There was, you know, maybe a feeling of optimism given that he's got some, you know, certainly some financial wherewithal to him, and maybe the time period around Peter Karmanos as owner had run its course. Has he lost any of that goodwill attached to his new ownership tenure with how the Ron Francis situation has played out, or are people willing to give him the benefit of the doubt for at least a little while?
I mean, I think there's certainly that group of people that are going to look at this and say, you know, Ron is the fabric that has kept this whole, has been throughout this whole franchise. You know, as a player, as a coach for a while, as in management, everything, and really as the ambassador to, you know, to the NHL for the Hurricanes. You know, Ron is a, like I said, a super classy guy, and just had nothing but good things to say about Ron Francis as a person and as an executive, and certainly as a player. So I mean, that's tough. Those things are hard, and that's part of the problem with taking a guy who is an icon in your franchise's history. And you could say the same about Rod Brind'Amour. If they decide to move on from having Rod Brind'Amour as an assistant, or, you know, don't choose him to be head coach, he's a candidate too, I suppose. You know, it's going to sting people a little bit, but that's what you run when you do these things. So, you know, Tom Dundon said he wasn't patient. He said this team needs to make changes. I mean, you can argue that these are bad moves and that it's bad PR, but it's really bad PR to miss the playoffs, as many years in a row as the Hurricanes have. And, you know, the future of the franchise is contingent on being a team that can compete, and they haven't competed in a long time. So, you know, the least you can do, I think, and anyone can do, is give Tom Dundon a chance to put his people in place and make some changes and see if the results change. Because the way things have been done under Peter Karmanos and, you know, under Jim Rutherford's watch and then followed by Ron Francis hasn't been enough. I don't think anyone can argue with that. So, maybe in a few years we'll see Buffalo and Carolina, two teams picking 1 and 2, back in an Eastern Conference final like they were back in 2006, which was a fantastic series. So we'll see what happens. I don't know. I think we're not done with the interesting stuff out of Raleigh just yet.
For our sake and the need to fill radio airtime, we hope that's the case. Corey Lavallette is covering the Carolina Hurricanes for the North State Journal. Corey, appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of the playoffs.
Thanks, Corey. Appreciate your time. When we come back, we talk more about Tom Wilson's suspension for his hit on Zach Aston-Reese and the Capitals and Penguins. It was an epic game last night. We talk about that series as well. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
It's thrown toward the front, and now coming up with it is Backstrom moving out with Ovechkin in a 2-on-1. Backstrom moving on, across to Ovechkin, he scores! With 1:07 to go! Alexander Ovechkin has broken the tie with 67 seconds left.
Doc Emrick with the call. A great call last night. The Capitals victorious in Pittsburgh.
Doc is the best.
Doc is the best. Great
awesome.
Call. He's fantastic. The huge victory for the Washington Capitals last night. And we'll talk about the Tom Wilson suspension. If you're just joining us, Tom Wilson, about 40 minutes ago, or give or take, suspended 3 games for his hit on Zach Aston-Reese. But I don't want it to get lost in the shuffle. Just how good of a game that was last night. Just how impressive a victory it was for the Washington Capitals to go into Pittsburgh and steal home ice advantage back. And just how good Alex Ovechkin has been in this series so far. He always gets the slings and arrows, and he never gets enough praise. Last night, Crosby-esque game-winning goal, taking the pass from Nicklas Backstrom. Initially, his initial shot hits the post, and somehow has the presence of mind to stay with the play and bat the rebound of his own shot off the post to the open net.
He's been watching Crosby.
He's been watching Crosby. Yeah. 67 seconds to go, and you could see, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw the highlight, but he goes and he jumps into the glass at the arena in Pittsburgh, at PPG Paints Arena, and is just screaming with emotion to, you know, anybody who ever accuses Alex Ovechkin of not wanting it needs to just watch that clip. And you see a guy who really does look, to some extent, like he's on a mission, at least to get past the Penguins this round.
Well, of course, we only saw the highlights. The game was happening at the same time as the Jets game, Drew.
I know.
You were there.
I know. But I'm saying if you miss the highlights, maybe. I know you are.
And we watched the game, you know, between the intermissions a little bit. But, you know, you make a good point. I mean, is this the year that Alex Ovechkin and the Capitals finally defeat the Penguins? It's only 3 games here, boys. So, I mean, it's 2-1. You know that the Pittsburgh Penguins are going to be firing on all cylinders in their home barn tomorrow night. But, you know, you look at this Penguins team right now, and, you know, they're not getting the goaltending that they're used to from Matt Murray over the last couple of seasons. Matt Murray has struggled, and Braden Holtby, guys, has been phenomenal since coming into this into these playoffs for Washington after Philip Grubauer struggled in the first two games against Columbus. Washington has not lost on the road yet this year in the playoffs.
Sure, they
They've won every single game on the road in the playoffs. It's truly incredible. And I agree, Drew. Ovi's been excellent. Nicklas Backstrom has been excellent. And, you know, for me, the big issue for Pittsburgh right now is they're not getting that scoring from that third line that they're used to, right? So you're talking about Phil Kessel, and they're not getting any scoring from anybody, really, with the exception of Sidney Crosby and Jake Guentzel on that top line. Patrick Hornquist is now back on that top line, and Evgeny Malkin was back. He assisted, picked up an assist on the power play. Patrick Hornquist got the goal there. So, you know, Malkin's back and healthy, but, you know, Phil Kessel's a guy, the last couple of years in the playoffs, he's been a top goal scorer for them. He hasn't been good in this series, so, you know, Phil Kessel's got to step up, and, you know, that entire third line for the Penguins, that's a key for me.
Yeah, you know, Derek Brassard, who was their big trade deadline acquisition to sort of play that third line role, that, you know, he was injured for part of the end of the regular season, but he certainly hasn't, you know, been great for the Penguins as they've been looking to fill that void that they lost in the offseason when Nick Bonino left Pittsburgh and went to Nashville. And that was what Brassard was brought in to really fill that third line centerman role. And for whatever reason, he just hasn't clicked right now with the Penguins, and they need something to get going there with that third line, as you mentioned, or else, you know, the Capitals, the way that they're playing, I mean, it could very easily right now be 3-0 for the Capitals. If you remember, they had that lead in game one that they blew where they were up 2-0 on home ice, and they lost 3-2. You know, you can make the argument the Capitals have been the better team through, you know, these three games.
Yeah, and I think there's a really good chance, Sean, that this series is tied after tomorrow night. And we know how good Pittsburgh is at home, and, you know, they know that, similar to the Nashville Predators, they know if they go down 3-1 heading back to Washington, say goodnight, the series is over. So I expect a big response, and I expect Matt Murray to be better. But, I mean, you know, Matt Murray, I mean, we know even in the regular season he wasn't himself. And yes, he has dealt with injuries here this season, but, I mean, if you watch the games, and obviously we didn't watch the game live in its entirety, but, you know, Matt Murray's numbers have not been good in the playoffs.
I would agree with that. He's been struggling, and, you know, they don't have the safety net of Marc-Andre Fleury anymore, and that's, you know, when you don't have another option behind him, that's what you end up with. Let's talk now about the suspension. And before I get you guys, your guys' opinion, I want to play from last night's, the post-game show on TSN. I want to play, I think this is Jamie McLennan, what Jamie McLennan had to say about the Tom Wilson hit on Zach Aston-Reese. In case you, of course, missed it, Wilson suspended for 3 games for this hit. Here's Jamie McLennan's comment.
Until the league takes away all headshots, regardless if they're accidental or on purpose, with a body hit, you're going to see these types of hit, and you're going to see these type of gray area perception plays from everyone in the Twitter world and inside the hockey world, because a lot of times people are saying, what is this hit? Is this a suspendable hit or not? Right now, by the letter of the law, that's not a suspendable hit.
Not a suspendable hit. So you have a player in Jamie McLennan coming out and saying that's not a suspendable hit by the rule of the rules and by, you know, how the rule book is written. Yet the NHL Department of Player Safety thinks it's worthy of a 3-game suspension. I mean, either the rule book needs to be changed, which a lot of people are saying today that that's the problem, is the rule book, or the interpretation needs to be changed. I mean, it's just, again, this gray area where it doesn't matter who's in charge of the Department of Player Safety. They oftentimes, you just throw up your hands in the air and say, well, I don't know if that's a suspension or not.
Yeah, there's a lot of inconsistency coming out of the NHL Department of Player Safety. And, you know, we saw Evander Kane get suspended in the Golden Knights Sharks series. But as far as I'm concerned, this should have probably got a game, maybe two. But I think Tom Wilson, as I mentioned last hour, Drew, I think Tom Wilson is being suspended for a game or two extra because they missed the call on Brian Dumoulin. I mean, the Penguins team, the Penguins management and coaching staff, and obviously the players too, but the management were arguing that Tom Wilson should be suspended for that hit on Brian Dumoulin that knocked him out of the lineup. And they didn't suspend him, so I think they're maybe giving him an extra game or two because they missed the call on Dumoulin. That's my opinion, but I thought 3 games was a little harsh.
It's interesting. It really is. And I also kind of echoed that sentiment where the NHL is maybe thinking, okay, well, we missed this, so maybe we have to do that.
Right.
And the thought maybe that they have to almost make amends for allowing such an event to take place? Because had he been suspended, obviously this would have been prevented. I'm talking about the Dumoulin hit, of
course.
Sure,
the initial hit, the one that...
caused the initial concern about headshots, and then Mike Sullivan comes out yesterday and
said... I thought that hit was worse, too.
The hit
on Dumoulin was worse, and he didn't get anything for that.
I thought on that one, he clearly picked the head, and the contact was directly to the head. Last night, he just goes... I mean, Wilson is a bigger guy hitting a smaller guy in Zach Aston-Reese. I don't know what the NHL expects Wilson to do on that. If not, maybe they just don't want him to lay that body check. I mean, how else is he supposed to play it? And I don't know what the answer is. Is he just supposed to try and stick check the guy?
And Sean, you know, I'll let you get back in here. I just wanted to say further to your point, we were talking about this 2 weeks ago. Drew raised this, and I didn't agree with it, but why are you suspending a guy for something that was missed in a previous game? A lot of people thought Josh Morrissey was suspended in the first round because there was no penalty call on his cross-check to the head of Eric Staal, right?
But so Mike Richards said that wasn't worthy of a suspension.
Well, you can't suspend a guy because you missed something in-game.
And clearly the NHL feels differently about
it. There was no penalty
it.
For that, for the hit yesterday.
Yeah, it was a clean hit deemed on the ice, and all of a sudden it's worthy of 3 games off. I mean... I think that the NHL has rabbit ears. So they hear media, they hear the public howling that kind of hit.
They have to be able to tune that out. I realize that sometimes, you know, the public outcry is tough to ignore, Drew, but this is going to possibly change the complexion of this series. I mean, Tom Wilson's a good player. I mean, everyone thinks of Tom Wilson as being kind of this fourth line mucker.
Yeah.
He's been on the top line for the Capitals.
He's been playing with Ovechkin and Backstrom all year long. It's, you know, the NHL, I mean, obviously concussions and head injuries are crucially important. And we don't want to ever be accused of diminishing the impact of head injuries.
It was a hit to the head. I just don't know based on.
But
you know,
hits
what
to the head
what,
are legal in the NHL.
Well, and that's a problem. I'm not saying that either. I mean, hits to the head, you know, they have to be taken out of the game. I mean, you're obviously going to have some hits to the head based on the nature of hockey, guys. We know hockey's a contact sport, but I just think 3 games for Tom Wilson is harsh based on what the Department of Player Safety has doled out in the past.
Until the NHL changes the rule to make all head hits, you know, a penalty, which
right.
I think they should. It's a little silly that they don't in this day and age.
Yes.
More than a little silly. Until the NHL changes the rule, I don't know how you can suspend a player for doing his job. I mean, change the rules so his job isn't to do that. And then you don't really have an argument from anybody. More on the series between the Capitals and the Penguins up next with Seth Rohrabaugh of TheAthletic.com. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of hour number 2. Welcome back to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN 1290. Drew Mindell, Ezra Ginsberg, Sean Assor with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From TheAthletic.com in Pittsburgh, we're pleased to be joined by Seth Rohrabaugh. He's covering the Penguins and the Capitals. The Capitals have a 2-1 series lead. Seth, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you.
Seth, let's start with the news that came out about 40 minutes ago. Tom Wilson, a 3-game suspension for his hit on Zach Aston-Reese. Obviously, it was a devastating hit. Aston-Reese, broken jaw, concussion, out of the Penguins lineup for the foreseeable future. Did the NHL Department of Player Safety get it right with a 3-game suspension, especially given that a lot of commentators said that, you know, what Wilson did was not in violation of the letter of the law for the NHL?
I think they did. And, you know, you maybe can debate the number of games, but the fact that they took some action on him, I think, and suspended him for any games, I think was the right call. And honestly, watching it last night and watching the replays I had available to me last night, I didn't think it would be. Just from the basis that Zach Aston-Reese was fully aware of the hit, or the oncoming hit, I guess. But watching the suspension video about 40 minutes ago, they showed another replay angle that wasn't immediately available. It's actually the replay angle from like the blue line, which they use for, delay offside potential reviews or whatever. And it showed a pretty clear version of the main point of contact or the principal point of contact being Aston Reese's head. And that maybe changed my opinion in that regard. But based on how the NHL outlaid the video and suspension video and all that, I support their decision. And I'm of the mindset too. I kind of take Ken Dryden's standpoint in that any type of hit to the head should be subject to some sort of discipline. But I'm surprised that the NHL did make the right call in this situation.
Seth, I know you've written about this recently for The Athletic. The secondary scoring for the Penguins right now, we know how good the top line of Crosby, Gensel, and Hornquist has been all playoffs long, but when you look at that third line of Derek Brassard and Phil Kessel and Connor Sheary right now, does it go without saying that they need more from that third line and the second line as well, Malkin's line?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, in fairness to Malkin, he just came back yesterday or last night from missing three games due to a left leg injury he suffered against Philadelphia in the first round. He was playing well up until that point, but really they haven't gotten much really from that point on from anyone below that first line, as you mentioned. And even the power play, they didn't get a goal for, I think, 16 straight opportunities until Malkin came back last night too. So, but you mentioned Phil Kessel there. It's a pretty big spotlight on him right now in that he only has one goal so far in these playoffs. And this is a guy who led the playoffs over the course of the previous two postseasons in goal scoring. And he had some assists. He picked up some assists last night, and that's nice. But they need more out of him. And I think one of the reasons they have been so successful is they've had such a talent imbalance compared to other teams where, they can put those three guys, Crosby, Malkin, Kessel, on three different lines and expect a fair amount of scoring threat from all three lines. And they're just not getting that right now whatsoever. And really, the bulk of their scoring this series, even going back to the last game of the Philadelphia series, has been done by that top line with Jake Gensel, Patrick Hornquist, and Sidney Crosby. So, I suspect Phil Kessel's not completely healthy. He had a pretty rough hit into the boards in Florida against the Panthers late in the regular season, and he kind of, sat out like the late stages of that game, and really ever since then he hasn't quite looked right really since that point, and that seems to have extended here into the playoffs. But clearly I think for them to get past the Capitals and move forward, they need a little bit more of a contribution from Phil Kessel offensively.
Seth, someone that's looking really right now is Jake Gensel. Is this guy showing that he's just not Sidney Crosby's sidekick? This guy can be what Paul Maurice here, coach of Winnipeg Jets, likes to call a real driver?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. You saw what he kind of did last year in the postseason, and I think he garnered a few votes for the Conn Smythe award, through that crazy playoff run last year. And, this regular season, he had a 20-goal season. It was okay, and he kind of just, you wonder if he was going to hit a sophomore slump. It was his first full NHL season, and you figure maybe the rigors of such would take a toll on him, and maybe they did during the regular season. But you saw how he just kind of exploded out of the gate here against Philadelphia. He had a 4-goal game there in Game 6. He's probably been their most consistent goal scorer in this series against Washington. He's putting up numbers that, they're not just impressive. They're historic numbers. I think I saw something, the natural 4-goal hat trick he had against Philadelphia. It's only been done like three other times in like 100 years. You're talking like Dave Kerr in 1985, or I'm sorry, Tim Kerr in 1985, and, Nuzi Lalonde with the Montreal Canadiens in 1919. These are numbers at a different stratosphere, what he's putting up. I think I saw another one where like the only people with, more goals over the first 20 some games of his career were like Mark Messier and Wayne Gretzky. So, there's a level this guy has hit in the postseason. It's really hard to explain, and the Penguins don't even really seem to understand what's going on with him when the calendar hits April and May and June and whatnot. But he's really doing things at a really different level that I don't think many other players are hitting.
Seth Rohrbaugh is our guest on NHL this week. We're talking about the Penguins-Capitals series. The Capitals lead 2-1. Last night certainly was a heated encounter, Seth. Two questions for you. One, did Tom Wilson laugh at Zach Aston Reese's injury? And did Sidney Crosby spit at one of the Capitals players?
I would say no and no to both of those. The explanation on Tom Wilson as offered by Barry Trotz today was Tom Wilson was shown on the video board. There were 19,000 people booing him all at once, and someone on the bench kind of said something, "Oh, they're all your friends here cheering you," and he's kind of laughing to that joke. Ultimately, it just wasn't a good moment, or visually, I guess, for the Capitals, with, you know, them cleaning ice off, you know, blood off the ice at that moment. But now I would tend to imagine that he was maybe just laughing at the fact he was being booed and showed on the video board at that moment. And as far as Sidney Crosby, no, that's not within Sidney Crosby's, character, to do something like that. And even some of the Capitals even kind of said, no, he didn't do that. And that's not really part of his nature. And, you know, although Barry Trotz kind of threw it out there, in an open-ended, query today about that. But, no, I don't think, Sidney Crosby would ever stoop to something like that, in terms of spitting on another player.
You know, Seth, I'm shocked, but we haven't asked you about the goaltending yet. And, you know, we have to ask you about Matt Murray. He backstops the Pens to back-to-back Stanley Cup championships. But, you know, he didn't have his best game last night, and he struggled at times in the first-round series against Philadelphia. How concerned are you with Matt Murray's goaltending, and how concerned should Mike Sullivan be with Murray's goaltending?
I don't think they should be concerned. It's maybe a point of curiosity right now, especially since I think the number I cited last night was 7 of the 10 goals he's allowed this series so far have come at his goal hit tending hand, or I'm sorry, his glove hand. And that's maybe a curiosity. That's always been kind of like the question mark about Matt Murray is his glove hand. You know, why does he always seem to give up, you know, goals in that area of things? But the Capitals certainly seem to be trying to take advantage of it. But, Matt Murray even acknowledged, you know, game 3 was not his best effort. And you saw there were a lot of goals or rebounds where he allowed, where they kind of squirted through his equipment, or, you know, went a little bit wide, you know, gave some anxious moments overall. But, Matt Murray's, as you mentioned, he's guys won 2 Stanley Cups. He knows what to do this time of year. He knows how to reset after bad games or bad losses, or even after good games or good saves. He really has a boring personality almost in that regard, where, he knows how to kind of reassess things and just focus on the next opportunity, the next game, what have you. And I would fully anticipate Matt Murray maybe having a good reset here for game 4. They need him to be better, particularly when they aren't getting that secondary scoring that they've enjoyed the previous 2 years.
Seth, was it odd to watch someone shoot the puck, drive the net, and then bat it out of the air, but rather than wearing 87 in black and yellow, it was just 8 in red? Was that odd to watch?
It was frustrating to watch because I had a pretty good lead paragraph written ready to go to overtime for a story I wrote, and then I had to rewrite everything.
Rewrite.
But that's just me being pragmatic for my own concerns. But no, that was a marvelous effort by Alex Ovechkin. And what was even more marvelous was, when you consider the fact that the Capitals had been pinned in their own zone for over a minute, I want to say, close to a minute maybe. Nick Backstrom kind of mentioned that he jumped on and was maybe a little bit more fresher than some of his teammates at that juncture. But, Alex Ovechkin had a pretty lengthy shift leading up until that goal. And in fact, he was able to kind of, you know, show that energy and show that burst to help create that 2-on-1 and then have the wherewithal to stick with the rebound and bat the puck out of the air. Just all the credit in the world to Alex Ovechkin and his marvelous talents that he was able to kind of maybe fight off fatigue in that situation and score just a really, really clutch goal in that situation.
You know, Seth, I wanted to just go back to, you know, Zach Aston-Reese. You know, obviously, you know, Tom Wilson is suspended for the headshot on Zach Aston-Reese. But, you know, Aston-Reese, I think you'd agree, is a bit of an unknown around the league. Obviously, you cover the Penguins and you're familiar with him, but, you know, he's an undrafted player. This is his first year with the Penguins. He's playing on that fourth line, but he's actually turning out to be a pretty valuable player for Mike Sullivan there on the fourth line. Is this kind of one of those, you know, great finds by the Penguins?
Yeah, I mean, he did lead the NCAA in college hockey in the U.S. here in scoring his last full season there before he signed with the Penguins as an undrafted free agent. So I'm not sure how unknown he was, but he was maybe certainly a late bloomer, a guy who, you know, shook off any sort of setback in not being drafted and really established himself as a top-tier NHL prospect. Yeah, maybe not a top-tier, but a viable NHL contributor. This is his first full season professional hockey. He kind of went through some growing pains with their American Hockey League affiliate in Wilkes-Barre-Scranton, really got past those and he really kind of developed his game in that, he's not just a guy, you know, putting up big numbers and stuff like that. He's really, developed a strong defensive conscience. If anything, he's actually maybe one of their more physical players, due in part because the Penguins really have skewed many, you know, having much of a physical element on their roster, if anything, but, He's a guy who's a regular on the penalty kill as well. You know, this is the guy who's playing alongside, you know, established penalty killers like Carl Hagelin and Riley Shahan and whatnot, and, you know, pick up some big minutes there. So, presuming he can get past this injury and, you know, fully recover over the offseason, he's going to be a guy that they lean on pretty heavily, going into the next season here. But, regardless of how they found him or how they developed him, he's really, you know, developed into a pretty significant role player for the Penguins so far.
Seth, last question for you. As I mentioned off the start, the Capitals now have a 2-1 series lead. You know, what's going to be the deciding factor? Is there one sort of X factor beyond the obvious that's going to make the determination as to which of these two teams is going to get through into the Eastern Conference Finals?
I just think it's going to be the secondary scoring for the Penguins. I mean, you look at what Washington is doing. Yeah, guys like Alex Ovechkin and some of the other big stars, Sean Carlson, are contributing, but they get a goal from Matt Niskanen last night. In game three, they get goals from Jacob Vrana and Brett Connolly. Whereas the equivalents of those players for the Penguins aren't doing that. They're not getting goals from Derek Brassard, who they paid a pretty heavy price to bring here. Riley Shahan's doing some nice things, but again, his offense is dried up. Even some, you know, lesser lights, like guys like Tom Kuhnhackl and Dominic Simone, maybe aren't necessarily offering that much. So they need to find ways to get better contributions from the role players. And presumably if they get a guy like Carl Hagelin back in the lineup and if Evgeny Malkin, you know, gets a little bit healthier, that helps. But it really, while the Capitals are enjoying, some secondary scoring, the Penguins are getting minimal contributions from the equivalent of those players on their roster right now.
Seth Rohrabaugh covers the Penguins for TheAthletic.com in Pittsburgh. The Penguins and the Capitals, Game 4, goes tomorrow night. Seth, appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
No sweat, guys. Take care.
Take care, Seth. Thanks again. When we come back, we have a new coaching hire. It's somebody with no NHL experience, Jim Montgomery, the new head coach of the Dallas Stars. We'll talk about it next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio, 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Jim Montgomery won a title as a player in 1993, now as a coach as Denver takes home its 8th national title in program history, 3-2, your final.
The Denver Pioneers won the NCAA Frozen Four in 2017.
Will Butcher.
Will Butcher was on that team. Now plays for the New Jersey Devils, of course.
Henrik Borgstrom.
He's going to play for the Florida Panthers next year. Ever since that victory, Jim Montgomery's name has been bandied about as a future NHL head coach. Montgomery was the head coach of the Denver Pioneers. Operative word is was, because he's now the new head coach, not yet officially announced, of the Dallas Stars, a Jets Central Division rival, looking for a new head coach after Ken Hitchcock resigned after 1 year behind the bench. You know, Montgomery, no NHL experience, but very well thought of, a sought after individual. A lot of teams have had him in the last couple of years for interviews.
Yeah, Florida, Calgary.
He gets the job now to be behind the bench in Dallas. Do you like this hire for the Dallas Stars?
Yeah, I do like it. And, you know, I didn't actually know this, but it turns out Jim Montgomery had a lengthy career in the National Hockey League. I didn't know this, but actually Jim Montgomery labeled the Legion of Doom line. Michael Renberg, John LeClair, Eric Lindros, because he played with those guys back in the 90s. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But, you know, Drew, you mentioned that Jim Montgomery, you know, he's been one of those coaches who has been talked about as being a future NHL coach. And, you know, on Friday, Sean Shapiro of NHL.com has announced that they are going, or maybe he might be with The Athletic now, Sean Shapiro.
Sean Shapiro is now with The Athletic.
Right, like everybody else. So Sean Shapiro, you know, breaking that news earlier today. And, you know, Dave Haxtell, guys, you know, he's got the Flyers into the playoffs, Sean, 2 of the last 3 years. And, you know, we were talking about that at the time when Dave Haxtell was hired. Obviously, you know, he had the great pedigree with the University of North Dakota. Brad Berry's obviously the coach there now, but, you know, that's what everybody was saying. Well, he's done it at the NCAA level, but can he translate that to the NHL? And I'm not saying necessarily, you know, that Jim Montgomery's going to get the Stars into the playoffs next year, but I wouldn't be surprised if he does, because this Stars team, I thought, was one of the most underachieving teams in the league. I think Edmonton was also one of the most underachieving teams in the West, but certainly Dallas, with that top line of Tyler Seguin, Jamie Benn, and Alex Radulov, I mean, they just didn't get the secondary scoring. As far as I'm concerned, they have to get better up the middle. I think, you know, Jason Spezza, Marty Hanzel, I think those guys are more likely, you know, third and fourth line centers on a good team as opposed to second and third line centers.
Mm-hmm.
You probably also have to bring in a top four defenseman. Dan Hamhuis is a pending UFA, but, you know, back to Montgomery.
You need a better backup goaltender. Yeah.
Sean, Montgomery's got the pedigree. I mean, we don't know, you know, if that's going to translate to the NHL level, but if you listen to what everybody in the hockey world says about Montgomery, they say he's an excellent coach. He's done a great job at giving that University of Denver program an identity. They've been a powerhouse in American college hockey, so I think he'll probably do an excellent job there in Dallas.
He has a couple of ties to the Dallas Stars. He played 8 games for them back in 2001-02 and actually played another game in 2002-03. So he played, you know, had 9 NHL games with the Dallas Stars. He's got some ties here to Winnipeg as well. Played 67 games for the Manitoba Moose of the IHL back in 99-2000. So
was Alexander Korolyuk on that team?
He might have been. I mean, I'd have to look back at the
Greg Pankowitz?
I remember the Manitoba Moose of the IHL. There were some great legendary sort of veterans, because that was, of course, the
shout out to
league.
Vinny Riendo.
Vinny Riendo.
Vincent Riendo.
That's the
used
first
to
time,
play for the St. Louis Blues.
It's the first time the anybody Blues. Shouted out Vinny Riendo, aside from maybe his wife in a long, long time. You know, Sean, the Stars have gone through the veteran coach way recently. You know, they went with Lindy Ruff for a while, then they went with Hitchcock. You know, do you think, you know, it's time for that new voice and getting a guy giving his first opportunity? You know, certainly coming in with a lot of experience, a lot of a pedigree, and been up and down the different, you know, scratching and clawing his way to a pro hockey career for a lot of years that took him from the Missouri River Otters of the UHL all the way to the Peoria Rivermen of the IHL. You know, he's certainly been up and down the roads of the hockey world.
Yeah, he's definitely paid his dues, and he's got a championship pedigree along the way, from 2 championships in the USHL, like you just talked about, in 3 seasons there, and then he goes to the college ranks, and he wins a Division I national championship, and he gets his team into the competitive NCAA playoff tournament 4 of his 5 years there. So the guy's got a winning pedigree, and I think they just need to shake it up a bit in Dallas. I mean, you talked about Lindy Ruff and Ken Hitchcock being the 2 primary faces behind the bench for a long time, and so they're so defensively minded and defensively oriented. And when you have such a high-powered potential offensive roster, I think maybe you can think, all right, well, maybe a different philosophy is needed. I wonder if he's going to walk into the Dallas Stars dressing room and just see a picture of Patrick Laine and just with a big line saying, don't let this guy score on us.
They haven't had much success in preventing Patrick Laine from scoring on them yet, so that might be a new strategy.
You know, I know we've only got a minute or two left here, but, you know, just quickly looking at that 99-2000, Manitoba Moose roster. I just thought I'd throw out some
going
more
down
names.
The memory.
A lot of shout-outs here.
Shout-out to Bill Bowler, who led the Moose in scoring that year with 20 goals and 62 points. What about my boy Lonnie Bahanas? Had 18 goals and 51 points this year. Sean Pronger was on that team. Who else? We got Jeff Parrott, defenseman on the team. Patrice Tardif, who was involved in the Wayne Gretzky trade. Brian Chapman, good solid stay-at-home defenseman. Lots of good players on that 99-2000 Moose team.
Former Manitoba Moose head coach Keith McCambridge played 3 games for the Moose back in 99-2000.
I always loved Lonnie
Bahanas.
He was always kind of that late-season call-up for the Leafs, if you remember.
I do remember that. The Leafs weren't very good those years. That's sort of, I think, how it boiled down.
He's a good Winnipeg boy, though.
He was a good Winnipeg boy. Always a lot of fun to go down the history, the annals of the Manitoba Moose of the IHL era. Rory, are you going to hit the button or you want me to keep going? Okay, Rory's telling me to keep going a little bit longer. Any of the names you got jump out there at you there? Vlad Serov, he played 51 games. I don't know who Vlad Serov is. Did you mention Brian Chapman? He played 80 games for the Moose that year.
Yeah, I mentioned Brian Chapman. Wasn't he the captain of the Moose?
I think he was the captain of the Moose back in the day there. You know, and the goaltender, Manny Lagesse.
Oh.
Yep.
There you go. He's played 42 games for
former
the Moose.
Red Wings goaltender.
Red Wings goaltender is Rhett.
Former member of the Canadian Olympic team.
Yeah, I do remember that. That's sort of probably when he had his most, public, I guess, legacy? Maybe not legacy. Legacy, that sort of thing?
Let me get this back on the rails here.
Okay.
I know I took it off of the rails,
right,
but let's get
rails.
Back on the rails here with 1 minute left. You know, Jim Montgomery, I mean, not only does Jim Montgomery have a lot of work ahead of him, just getting familiar with the Dallas Stars team, but, you know, Jim Nill, we talked about it. I mean, he's got a lot of work in front of him here, deciding what to do in the trade market, and obviously, you know, they've got a higher draft pick, you know, not as high as maybe they would have liked. They probably would have liked to win that lottery, but after a really disappointing season in Dallas, I mean, this isn't a rebuilding team. I think they're going to be aggressive in free agency and via the trade market.
Huh?
Not sure who they go after. I mean, I don't know if necessarily they go big game hunting and go after a John Tavares, for example.
They went big game hunting last year, and
we'll
didn't really work out for them.
John Tavares would look really good there in Dallas. If you got Sagan and Tavares, that's pretty darn good.
You look good on any team's roster. That's it for this Wednesday edition of NHL This Week. Quick programming note, next week, Tuesday night for NHL This Week, because Wednesday's got the Moose Rockford Hogs game as well. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support them because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. In case you missed any of the show, it'll be available for download on our website, illegalcurve.com, and wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, get it sent to you automatically each and every week. Big props to producer Rory McGoran, doing a great job behind the board, making us sound good. For Sean Asor, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday at 9 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck, and thanks for listening to NHL This Week on TSN Radio 1290.
As long as we stick together as a team, we'll be all right.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.